This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the first things many of us learn to recite as a child is the Pledge of Allegiance. In a new book about the history of the pledge, my guest Richard Ellis says the daily recitation in schools and legislatures across the nation tells us as much about our anxieties as a nation as it does about our highest ideals. Anxieties about immigrants, radicals, communism, and materialism. The pledge was written in 1892 as a salute for schoolchildren to say during a week-long public school celebration of the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovery of America. The magazine Youth's Companion promoted the celebration and declared its ambition to see the U.S. flag raised over every public school as part of the commemoration. The pledge was written by one of the magazine's writers, Francis Bellamy. Richard Ellis's new book is called To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. He's a professor of politics at Willamette University in Oregon. I asked him why he wanted to write about the Pledge of Allegiance.
One of the things that initially interested me in the book was why it was when the Ninth Circuit Court decided that Under God was unconstitutional in June 2002, why did people get so upset about it? And indeed, why does it matter to us so much that our children pledge allegiance at all? It struck me as an interesting ritual, and it still strikes me as a curious ritual. It's unusual by the standards of Western democracies. Most Western liberal democracies don't have their children start the day by pledging allegiance to the nation. And certainly not pledging allegiance to a nation under God. And so I think what drew me to the history of the Pledge of Allegiance was answering that question, why did the United States do this, and why did we care so much about it? Because clearly the reaction to that decision was intense.
Let's look at the history of the Pledge of Allegiance. What do you think is the most common assumption about the pledge that is actually false?
I think the most common assumption about the Pledge of Allegiance is that we've always had it. It was somehow put there by the founding fathers. And the Pledge of Allegiance isn't written until 1892, 100 years after the founding of the country. So why in 1892? And in 1892, what one has is increasing immigration, and in particular, immigration that's bringing people who look different, no longer Western and Northern Europeans, no longer just Protestants, but Catholics and Jews, and from Southern and Eastern Europe. And there's a great anxiety about that in the country in the late 1880s and into the 1890s. The misconception is that it's simply a statement about our ideals. It is that too, with liberty and justice for all, but it's also a statement that reflects a nation's anxieties.
So you're saying it reflects the anxiety of immigrants coming here. We want to make sure that they're pledging allegiance to the flag.
Right, right. And the adults, you can't do anything about the adults because they can't be reached, but what these people feels that the children can be reached. They can be molded. Interestingly, when the pledge is slightly revised, because the original pledge was, I pledge allegiance to my flag, and it was revised in the early 1920s by a collection of patriotic and veterans groups who felt they were worried that when these children were saying my flag, they meant the home country's flag. And so it was changed to the flag of the United States of America so that these immigrant children couldn't mistake which flag they were pledging or couldn't surreptitiously be pledging to their home country's flag.
Would you recite the pledge as it was initially written?
It was originally written, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. A much more elegant version of the pledge than we currently have.
The word indivisible is in the original pledge. Mm-hmm. And how much does that have to do with the recently divided nation during the Civil War?
Everything. It's absolutely a response to concerns about the Civil War. The more general anxiety is that in the post-war period, people have forgotten the sacrifices of the greatest generation, to use our phraseology for the World War II. But there was the sense that the Civil War generation was the greatest generation. They had made the supreme sacrifices for the nation and for the values for which it stood. And that in the late 19th century, people are absorbed with making money, the pursuit of individual happiness, materialism, and that they are forgetting about the sacrifices that the previous generations had made.
The pledge was written by Francis Bellamy and James B. Upham.
Yeah, the pledge is written by Bellamy. Upham is the one whose idea it is to have a flag over every schoolhouse.
Now, you mentioned that one of the reasons for the pledge was the fear of new immigrants, the fear of immigrants who didn't look like the people who already lived here. Where did Bellamy stand on immigration?
Bellamy very much shared that fear of immigration. And one of the things that drew me into this story was Francis Bellamy's biography and his beliefs, because what I had heard, the little bit I heard, I did hear that, well, Francis Bellamy was a Christian socialist, and I thought, well, that's interesting. But when I look more deeply, it seemed that the Christian socialism had a lot less to do with the pledge than Bellamy's fears about immigrants, fears about Catholics. And I came across something that Bellamy wrote a couple years after the pledge. It just struck me as quite ironic that the author of With Liberty and Justice for All also wrote this. He said, "The hard, inescapable fact is that men are not born equal. Neither are they born free, but all in bonds to their ancestors and their environments. The success of government by the people will depend upon the stuff that people are made of. The people must guard, more jealously even than their liberties, the quality of their blood. A democracy like ours cannot afford to throw itself open to the world. Where every man is a lawmaker, every dull-witted or fanatical immigrant admitted to our citizenship is a bane to the commonwealth. Where all classes of society merge insensibly into one another, every alien immigrant or inferior race may bring corruption to the stock. There are races, more or less akin to our own, whom we may admit freely and get nothing but advantage from the infusion of their wholesome blood, but there are other races which we cannot assimilate without a lowering of our racial standard, which should be as sacred to us as the sanctity of our homes."
Which races or ethnic groups was he most worried about admitting?
Southern Europeans, Eastern Europeans, Jews, Catholics. Those are the primary religious groups and source of origin that he's concerned about.
Now, you're right that Bellamy, the author of the Pledge of Allegiance, was not only concerned about immigrants, outsiders who might come in and change our society in a bad way. He was worried about internal foes. Who was he worried about inside America?
When Bellamy's writing the pledge, his primary concern is immigrants and the native-born who aren't patriotic enough, not concerned about the Civil War generation. But later on, in the 1920s, as the pledge starts to spread, because originally the pledge is written for a single occasion, Bellamy doesn't think this is going to be something that's said every day in school or every week in school. But as it begins to spread in the early part of the 20th century and begins to become a widespread practice in public schools, that's when Bellamy starts to talk about the pledge in some different ways, and in particular about combating radical subversion, which becomes a strong concern for Bellamy and for others in the wake of World War I and the Russian Revolution. And so he writes about the way in which the pledge can be used to combat internal subversion. The pledge, in Bellamy's view, is almost like a vaccination. It will inoculate these children. They will start to feel an allegiance to the nation before they even understand the words, so that when they are exposed to the radical virus, they will be inoculated. And that's very much the way Bellamy saw the pledge.
Let's talk a little bit about how children were supposed to say the pledge. And initially, you weren't putting your right hand over your heart when you said the pledge. What were you doing?
Right. The pledge, as it's originally designed, and James Upham is the man who comes up with the salute, it begins with a military salute. I pledge allegiance to my flag. And at the words, my flag, the arm would be extended up into the air, palm upwards. And so visually, that looked quite a lot like the Heil Hitler salute. And so in the 30s, people start to become concerned about that, the late 30s and early 40s, that this Pledge of Allegiance, this salute, looks an awful lot like the Nazi salute. And in fact, there are pictures of people saying the Pledge of Allegiance from this period. And even though Upham's original idea was to have the arm and palm extended upwards, in fact, many people did it with the palm down. And so it really did look an awful lot like the Nazi salute for a while.
When did the Pledge of Allegiance become mandatory in schools?
The first flag salute statute dates from 1898 in New York State. But the first state to make the Pledge of Allegiance specifically mandatory was Washington State, and that happens in 1919, and that is in direct response and out of fear of a general strike that happens in Seattle at exactly that time. So the Pledge of Allegiance, in terms of a mandatory state statute, dates from that period, and it differs across states. But essentially, the Pledge of Allegiance in the period between the 1910s and the 1943 Supreme Court ruling is mandatory. If you don't say the Pledge of Allegiance, the school can throw you out of school. And in fact, they did throw the students out of school and sometimes arrested their parents because the students weren't they accused the parents of creating truants since the kids couldn't go to school. Even though it was the schools telling the kids they couldn't go to school, the parents were arrested.
So the Supreme Court declared the mandatory pledge laws unconstitutional?
Right. What happened is in the 1930s, 1935 in particular, Jehovah's Witnesses start to refuse to pledge allegiance to the flag. They decide that it's idolatrous to do so, and they refuse to pledge allegiance to the flag, and they get thrown out of school. But unlike some of the previous religious sects that had refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance, the Jehovah's Witnesses aren't shy about using the court system. So the Jehovah's Witnesses take the case to the courts, and they have lots of cases, and they lose in almost all of these cases. And in fact, they lose in front of the United States Supreme Court in 1940. And the United States Supreme Court says in an 8-1 ruling, and the decision, the opinion is written by Felix Frankfurter, an FDR appointee and a founding member of the ACLU. And the Supreme Court says the school board has the power and the state has the power to expel students from school if they don't say the Pledge of Allegiance, that the courts need to take a hands-off approach, and the state has a reasonable interest in promoting, a compelling interest, in fact, in promoting patriotism. Well, the reaction to that opinion is strongly critical, and in particular what happens is you get a lot of violence visited against Jehovah's Witnesses. They get beaten up. In one case of castration, being forced to drink castor oil. And the people that are doing this are pointing to the Supreme Court case and saying, look, the Supreme Court says they're traitors. The court people, some of the people on the court get very nervous about these events, and they start to feel like we made a mistake. And so 3 years later, 1943, on Flag Day, Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, who was the Attorney General for FDR, in 1940, but now sits on the Supreme Court. He writes the opinion, and the Supreme Court changes course. And in some of the most famous language, Justice Jackson says it's a matter of freedom of expression, and if a student's choose not to say the Pledge of Allegiance, that should be something that they should be able to choose to do, to not to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
So the Supreme Court reversed its own decision?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very unusual in 3 years. And you have to understand the first opinion in 1940 was handed down at the time that the Nazis are just beginning to roll over Europe. It's the spring and early summer of 1940. The Nazis are rolling over Europe, and there is tremendous anxiety. And so there's a feeling on the part of the court that the state really does have a compelling interest to promote patriotism.
The two most controversial words in the pledge are "under God," words that are still being contested today in the courts. And these two words were added in 1954 during the Cold War. How much was "under God" a way of trying to differentiate America from, you know, quote, godless communists, unquote?
Yeah, it had had everything to do with that. It's putting the pledge at the service of the fight against communism, because at the end of the Cold War, the communists posed primarily just a military threat. But in the early years of the Cold War, communism was seen as a dangerous rival for the allegiance of the people of the United States and the people across the world. The United States stood for liberty and justice, but the communists claimed to stand for justice and equality too. And people worried that communism was able to instill a fierce, fanatical loyalty that the West couldn't match. And so many people came to believe in those early years of the Cold War that fighting communism required recommitting the nation to its religious roots, that it was religion, the belief in God, that really differentiated us from the godless, atheistic communists. And that's where our sense of commitment would come from. And of course, if God's on our side in this cosmic battle with communism, that's an immensely reassuring thought at a terribly anxious time. One of the things that's useful to remember is that the change to the pledge is one of only a number of things that were done in the early 1950s to inject religion into the public sphere. And they all have to do with this concern about communism. In 1952, Congress mandates an annual National Day of Prayer. Eisenhower begins each cabinet meeting with the silent prayer. Today's National Prayer Breakfast, which was then called the Presidential Prayer Breakfast, dates from that period. Congress created a prayer room in the Capitol during that period. In 1955, Congress added "In God We Trust" to paper money. Coins already had it. In 1956, "In God We Trust" became the national motto, replacing "E Pluribus Unum." The post office even got into the act and issued a stamp adorned with "In God We Trust" on it, and it was unveiled on national TV by the president, members of his cabinet, and religious leaders.
Michael Newdow challenged the words "under God" in the pledge, and in 2002, a federal court sided with him, but 2 years later, the Supreme Court throughout the decision and basically said that Michael Newdow didn't have any standing in the case because he brought this case on behalf of his daughter. But the Supreme Court said that since he and his wife were divorced and he didn't have direct custody over the daughter, that he had no standing in the case.
Right.
So he's challenging it again with right. four other people. What's this current case?
Well, this case will force the Supreme Court to take the subject on its merits. It was able to decide the case on a technical issue of standing and therefore avoid the question of whether including "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance violates the Establishment Clause. But in any event, there seem to be three possibilities. One is you follow Rehnquist and say that Establishment Clause precedents really aren't relevant here because the Pledge of Allegiance is not a religious exercise. "Under God" is a descriptive statement about our belief in God in the past, our founders' belief in God. And so it's not about our aspirations to be a nation under God. It's a descriptive statement. It's not a religious exercise. You can also envision a version of that talks about it being fundamentally ceremonial deism. It's like in God we trust on the money. It's drained of its religious content. And that's one possibility. The second possibility is that the court would decide to follow Clarence Thomas and argue that the pledge case shows why Supreme Court jurisprudence in this area has to be rethought and rolled back. And if the lower courts applied Establishment Clause jurisprudence and found the Under God clause to be unconstitutional, that only shows how bad those previous Establishment Court cases and precedents are, and we need to rethink fundamentally Establishment Clause jurisprudence. And the third possibility is that it follows the Ninth Circuit ruling, which was to apply Establishment Clause precedents and strike down the Pledge of Allegiance. And I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that one is more likely than two or three.
One of the things you trace in your history of the Pledge of Allegiance is how the pledge became politicized. And of course, you know, you write about how during the war in Vietnam that a lot of people refused to stand for the pledge as a way to protest the war. And then you write about the 1988 presidential campaign between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis, and you say that the pledge became a partisan issue in that campaign. How was the pledge used?
Well, using the pledge, first of all, the Pledge of Allegiance becomes available to be used in partisan battles because the protests against the pledge start to be associated with a political point of view in the 60s and 70s, whereas prior to that, it was often religious objections, and it didn't have the same kind of political partisan implications that it started to take on in the 60s and 70s. And so in the 88 campaign, the Republicans, for the first time, really make it a national issue. It had been used in some local campaigns in political ways in New York State and other places. But they're able to put Dukakis in a very uncomfortable position. Dukakis had previously vetoed a state law requiring the Pledge of Allegiance. And it was pretty clear that on legal grounds, Dukakis was on very solid footing. But the problem was that the American public believed and still believe to this day that the Pledge of Allegiance should be mandatory. And public opinion polls clearly show that. So Dukakis talks about the legalisms, but for the public, this is just another piece of evidence that courts are out of step with the public. And so Bush is able to use that. He's in a win-win situation there. He's able to use that and play on people's feelings that there's these liberal courts and that they're out of touch with the people and that they're even telling us that we can't require students to say the Pledge of Allegiance, which indeed the courts had been saying since 1943, but oftentimes school boards, it took a while for them to get the message.
One of the kind of funny things about the pledge is that it's mostly, you know, like school children have recited it, and you learn it when you're like five or six, and you don't know what any of it means, particularly the word indivisible. I mean, most kids don't even know how to pronounce it. And, you know, if you listen to kids saying the pledge, it's just a lot of, like, odd syllables strung together. So sure. It's really, the language is much too formal for children to truly comprehend, although, you get the gist of it, but...
Right, right. Well, indivisible, of course, is the classic one. Lots of kids think it's invisible. But Bellamy did understand that. He understood that kids, when they were saying this, wouldn't necessarily understand what they were saying. But later on, when it was became clear that the pledge was something that would be said on a regular basis, he thought of the pledge as something that touched kids' feelings. And what it was not about thinking. It was about attaching the heart to the nation in a way. And so it's a pre-rational attachment. And later on, when they were called upon to explain, you know, what their country was about, they would then go back to those words. They would become part of their memory. Bellamy's way of thinking about it, he said it would do their thinking for them. It would be the way they understood who they were when they became older. It just got lodged in their subconscious. And Bellamy thought that was a good thing. I mean, that's the way propaganda works, too. And that's why some people have, are a little more nervous about it.
You're a historian, and I'm not sure if you'll be comfortable answering this in a personal way. But after learning the history of the pledge, are you any more or less inclined to want to stand and recite it?
One of the things that makes the Pledge of Allegiance, thinking about the Pledge of Allegiance, difficult is I think there are some people who feel uncomfortable pledging allegiance to the nation. It's not that they don't feel patriotic, but that they feel that there's something paradoxical or odd or strange about the most individualistic nation of the world, the leader of the free world, requiring its children to declare daily their allegiance to the state. And there's something illiberal about that. On the other hand, there are people for whom it feels the most natural thing in the world and a very authentic way of declaring their love for their country. And for those people, they have a hard time understanding the other people, and the other people have a hard time understanding the perspective of the other people, I think.
Richard Ellis, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Richard Ellis is the author of To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. He is a professor of politics at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon.